The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 24, Coronavirus Deep Dive with Eric Townsend, Part 1 of 2. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a really good buddy of mine, and he is the host of the best macro podcast out there. It's Macro Voices, Eric Townsend. Welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Wow, George. I love the introduction. Don't know if I deserve it, but I'll take it.
All right. So for my viewers or my listeners who aren't familiar with your backstory, can you fill us in on that really quick?
Sure. I was a software entrepreneur in the 90s, sold my company in 98, tried to be retired. That never works when you try to retire in your 30s. So I quickly got bored, reinvented myself as a full-time global macro trader, and then went on to run a hedge fund for about 5 years. And the style of investing that I pursue is kind of the Jim Rogers style of trying to understand the world around me and events in the world and translate that to what it will mean for financial markets. So I really feel compelled to be very, very clear. I am not an epidemiologist. I am not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I do not have any qualifications to make me an expert on viral epidemics or anything. What I do have is about 13 years of experience reading the work of experts and trying to quickly come up to speed on new subjects and translate them into their market and economic impacts and risk factors. So I'm trying to learn as much as I possibly can about viral epidemics, but it is new subject matter to me, and I do not profess to be an expert.
Yeah, but you did interview Dr. Chris Martinson the other day, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Chris is a super guy, and he has produced a whole bunch of videos, which I definitely recommend. His YouTube channel is called Peak Prosperity, and he is a PhD in pathology from Duke University. He's very well qualified to understand this subject matter, and he's been a source of much of the information. I'm also, just to give listeners a few other resources, some other people that I'm following: Dr. Eric Ding, D-R-E-R-I-C-D-I-N-G, on Twitter, is a Harvard University epidemiologist who has been very prolific in tweeting about this and explaining a lot of the concepts. He's an important guy to follow. Dr. John Campbell in the UK, and that's spelled like Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L. Is also has a YouTube channel. He, I don't know exactly what his PhD is in, but it's obvious that he has a lot of professional experience in the study of this field. He's produced a bunch of very detailed YouTube videos. Then on the finance side of this, there's a bunch of people that are paying close attention to it. One is Jim Bianco at Bianco Research. That's Bianco Research on Twitter. Another guy is Mike Shedlock, call sign Mish. Mish has done a bunch of tweeting about this and written some articles. And also Dr. Ben Hunt, who is Epsilon Theory on Twitter, just published an article about this and the release of information associated with it. So there's a whole bunch of people that are following this. And I think it's a very, very important story.
Okay, so let's dive into it a little deeper. I know that the media is telling us that it's no worse than a seasonal flu. It's got a lower death rate than SARS. It's kind of contained to China. But I know you and Dr. Martinson and a lot of other experts out there, people that have been studying extensively, disagree with that. Do you want to give us some insight on your views and what you've learned through your research?
Yeah, it's really scary the way the mainstream media, and actually they've started to come around just in the last few days. For a while, they were saying, hey, it's just a bad seasonal flu, don't worry about it, a much lower death rate. It does have a lower case fatality rate than SARS. That's the good news. But the thing is, it's also much more contagious than SARS was, and it's spreading much more quickly. There's already SARS killed 800 people out of 8,000 cases. That was a 10% death rate, which is really high. over the course of 6 months or more. This thing has already killed more than 1,100 people. Or maybe the figure is 1,000 and something. It's just under 1,100 people. How long has it been going? Well, it's only been a thing that people have been following for the last 3 or 4 weeks. Different experts think it may have started as early as the beginning of November in China when it started spreading. Nobody's really sure of that. But, you know, it's already killed more people than SARS. And it has the potential to be much, much bigger. I have been describing this as the most mispriced risk since subprime mortgages, and maybe even bigger than that. I'm not sure. Now, I want to be super duper clear, George, because people have been misinterpreting what I'm saying. I'm not predicting that there's necessarily going to be a global pandemic that sweeps the globe and, you know, millions and millions of people are affected by this. What I am telling you is that is a very real possibility, and the market is not discounting that possibility at all. The way the market is discounting this is, okay, it probably won't be as bad as SARS. People were saying it's just a seasonal flu. It looks like maybe the case count is peaking in China. We can come back to that later and get into a little bit more detail on that. What is possible here, and to give you an idea, there was one guy, Professor Gabriel Leung, who is the chair of public health and medicine at Hong Kong University. He said this morning that there is the potential, and again, I don't think he made a prediction that this would happen. He's saying, now, what's the worst case risk? 60 to 80% of the population of the entire planet could contract this infection if the transmissivity statistics and other things that we're monitoring turn out to be as bad as some indications suggest that they could be. Even if you assume a 1% case fatality rate instead of 10% for SARS, that would still yield 51 million people around the world dying from this thing. The market is not even beginning to remotely discount any possibility of something on that scale happening. Now, again, I cannot be emphatic enough. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. What I'm saying is there's very real science that says that is a possibility depending on how this goes. And we can talk about what some of the factors are as we get into this interview that are going to determine that. But the real point is the market is not, and I should correct myself, the actual death toll is 1,018 as of this morning. I think I said 1,100 a minute ago. My apologies. Let me just take a look at some of my notes here. The thing is, this is very, very infectious, and we're still shipping plane loads full of people in and out of China, and it is very infectious, very contagious, and those people have flown all over the world, and so it took quite a while to get started. If this thing started in November, we didn't really see the case count and the panic really take off inside China until the end of January. So if it's been spread to the rest of the world and it's just starting, it stands to reason that we shouldn't expect. You know, people are saying, wait a minute, there's been no deaths outside of China. Well, first of all, it's not true anymore. There have been some deaths outside of China, only a small handful. We shouldn't expect a lot of deaths outside of China. We shouldn't expect a large case count outside of China yet because of the time that it takes. There's a very long incubation period involved here. There's actually some new data about that just out in the last 24 hours. We can come back to that later on. But, you know, the real message here, George, is I'm not saying to panic. I don't want to freak anybody out. But what I am telling you is the market is acting like there's something that might maybe be as bad as SARS that appears to be ending already. And what we don't know yet is whether the rest of the world is going to go through what China has already been through, which is really, really bad.
Yeah. So I want to keep it kind of Corona specific, but one thing that really kind of sparked my interest about what you said is that the market hasn't discounted this yet, But have they? And what I mean by that is are we back to this whole thing of bad news being good news in the sense that the worse things get, the more the market assumes the Fed is going to print money and elevate markets. So let's just go all in. Is that a possibility?
I think that's a very distinct possibility, particularly for the stock market. Now, what we've seen already is crude oil, iron ore, and copper are really showing the signs of this. So commodities don't appear to be immune. We've got the stock market at all-time highs, but at the same time, it seems like what really sparked this rally last night that took us back to all-time highs as we're speaking was news that Zhang Nashan, who's a senior medical advisor to China, one of the guys who discovered the SARS virus, very senior guy, made comments saying that his models indicate that the peak of infections in China should be hit within the next couple of weeks. And that seems to have been the trigger to move the market higher. So I don't think that it's completely bad news is good news, but it's more of we know that there's going to be a bunch of stimulus as a result of this thing, no matter what. And so as soon as it looks like maybe it's ending, woohoo, let's go, you know, bid stocks even higher. The thing is, what this Zhang Nashan actually said is this epidemic in China may be peaking in terms of its infection rate. First of all, a lot of people are very skeptical of the official case count and infection rate coming from the Chinese government. It may be much higher than has been reported. But still, if what is being reported is it's peaking in China after it took 3 months to really get going, what about the rest of the world? Are we going to see a repeat of what happened in China throughout all of the other places that people have gotten on airplanes in China and flown to and been spreading this very contagious virus to? We don't know that yet. So is the next wave that's coming maybe much bigger and a global pandemic as opposed to something that's contained to China? Most people are assuming, oh, well, it's a really bad, bad situation, but it's over there in China. It's, you know, it's contained to China. We don't have anything to worry about here. Why would you think that when this very contagious disease is being carried by people getting on airplanes, flying all over the world and spreading it all over the world? So, you know, it remains to be seen what happens. But the market is definitely not discounting the global pandemic scenario. The market's acting like stimulus is coming. And I think that's that aspect of what you said is definitely true. This will result in more stimulus from central banks, and that's got to, you know, help markets. I don't think they've factored in the bad news for the economy. And, you know, it could be that those things don't happen. But in terms of discounting the probability risk, the possibility that those things could happen, it's not priced in as far as I can see.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also, I don't think that most Americans who are kind of U.S.-centric really understand, even if it is contained to China from an economic standpoint, that still has huge ramifications for the U.S. economy. But I think we'll get into that a little later in the interview. So one thing I wanted to go over is you had an incredible Twitter thread. No, actually, you've had a few of them on this coronavirus. So if anyone's not following you on Twitter, I'd strongly suggest that they do so. It's just, your handle's just your name, isn't it?
It's Eric, E-R-I-K-S, middle initial, Townsend. And there is another guy, Eric Townsend, with no middle initial. And I tried to buy the Twitter handle. He didn't want to sell it. So,
all right. But you've had some amazing threads on this coronavirus specifically. And you pointed out three specific factors that kind of created this kind of a perfect storm type scenario that differentiate it from SARS. Do you want to outline those for the listeners or viewers?
Yeah, let me describe what those three things are. First one is called asymptomatic transmission. What that means and how this differs from SARS, the way the SARS virus worked was you got the fever before you became contagious. So the way they were able to contain it, and the Hong Kong government in particular really deserves a lot of credit for how quickly they jumped into action. They just put these monitoring stations everywhere, entrances to buildings, airports, public transit, where they've got somebody taking your temperature with a little infrared thermometer. Anybody who's running a fever gets quarantined and tested for SARS, and that's how they were able to contain it and take care of it. The whole point was you had a symptom that could be tested with a simple thermometer before you became contagious. Now, with this virus, it has asymptomatic transmission, which means people who have contracted the virus, they've been infected with it, they don't get sick right away. And at first it was thought 5 days, for as long as 5 days, you could be infected and contagious and spreading the virus to other people, even before you realize that you're sick, and even before you start to run a fever yourself. So that means there's no way of using thermometers to test it. And even what you see going on in airports now, where they're screening people for fevers, they will be missing the vast majority of people who are transmitting the virus because those are asymptomatic spreaders. Now, there has been a little bit of back and forth among the scientists. The science itself is way over my head, but at first they were saying it's absolutely clear that there is asymptomatic transmission. Then they said, wait a minute, that may be a false indication. Maybe it's not being transmitted asymptomatically. Then somebody said, well, we've never had a global pandemic that was based on asymptomatic transmission ever before. If that sounds to you like housing prices have never declined nationwide, I think there's some similarity in those statements. So there is a little bit of uncertainty about is it the entire incubation period before you develop symptoms that you're contagious for that entire time, or is it just part of it? But the point is, there is some degree of asymptomatic transmission. That means that containment mechanisms like testing people for a fever with thermometers ain't going to work for this bug the way that it worked for SARS. Now, there's new information out just in the last 24 hours, and it's the same guy who said that it looks like we should see a peak in infections in China within the next couple of weeks. Zhang Nishan is a senior medical advisor to China. He's one of the guys who discovered SARS. He just came out with information saying that the incubation period may be as long as 24 days. So more than 3 weeks that you could be potentially contagious, not aware that you're sick yourself, and giving the virus to other people. Now, wait a minute. Did he say that you were asymptomatically contagious for those entire 24 days? Not so far as I've been able to see. That's an open question. That's an incredibly important open question. This information about 24 days has just come out. Is that 24 days for most cases? Most people have it that long? Or is that just an exception that happened once and most people develop symptoms after 5 days? We don't know yet. The point is the combination of the long incubation period and the possibility of spreading the virus during that incubation period before you even realize that you're sick and before it's possible for someone testing you to know that you are contagious, that means that the ability for authorities to contain the virus is extremely limited, and it requires completely different tactics than what worked with the SARS virus. The next thing is this number called R-naught, which I think you'll be hearing more and more about. And for our American listeners, naught is just British English for the number zero. Some American scientists call this R sub zero, which is the same thing. It's the letter R with a little zero subscript next to it. What that means is for any one person who's infected with the virus, how many people will they transmit it to within the community around them? And that's assuming no special precautions are taken to protect those people. So a virus like the common flu has an R naught of 1.28. That means that on average, a person who catches it will give it to 1.28 other people. And because that number is greater than one, it's self-sustaining. 1.28, it's kind of an exponential progression. If 1.28 times 1.28 times 1.28, each time people give it to someone else, it's a little more than one more person. It allows that virus to grow. when you get to an R naught of two people, all of a sudden you're into a geometric progression. So an R naught of 2.0 means one person gives it to two people. Those two people give it to four people. Those four people end up giving it, to, you know, and you get to 16, 512, 32,000 before you know it. So the number, the difference between one and two, it's not, it's twice as bad. It's an exponential progression as the value of R gets higher. We thought at first that this virus might be similar to SARS or the common flu. The common flu had an R naught of 1.28. SARS was about a 2.0. There has been a research paper, which we can come back to in a couple of minutes, because it has some very important other conclusions. Mm-hmm. It says that the R naught for this virus could be as high as 4 or higher. That is just freaky, scary high number. So that's number two. First thing is asymptomatic transmission makes it impossible to contain it. Next thing is high R naught value means that this is very, very contagious, much more contagious than the common flu. Right. The next one is, I think when people are focusing on the case fatality rate, obviously that's important. How many people die from this is something we should not be ignoring. But what they're missing, I think, is there's another number that you need to watch, which is the serious complication rate. Because let's suppose there's hopefully some good news here. And for a while, people thought there was a possibility this could have just as high of a case fatality rate as SARS, around 10%. Looks like 1% is probably going to be the more realistic number. And one of the things that was going on is they weren't counting all the cases early on. So if you're not dividing the death toll by all of the cases, you get an artificially high death toll. Looks like maybe 1% is the real number, but it looks like this virus has a serious complication rate of at least 15%. That means 15% of the people get it need to be hospitalized. Well, wait a minute. There's not enough hospitals and enough hospital beds to hospitalize 15% of major populations of people. And that's the reason that we're hearing all of these reports. And unfortunately, the Chinese government hasn't been completely forthcoming in telling us everything that's going on. But we're hearing a lot of unofficial reports out of China of people being turned away from hospitals, unable to get medical care, and so forth, because the medical care system is completely overwhelmed and can't handle all of the patients that exist. So a high serious complication rate, even if you don't have a high case fatality rate, has the risk of completely overwhelming the medical facilities of certainly, that kind of high number could overwhelm developed country medical facilities. You know, in the United States, there's less than 100,000 ICU beds in the whole country. We don't need to have that many people in intensive care all at once. This could change that. But perhaps more importantly, George, think about emerging market economies. Think about places like India. If this broke out in India the way that it's breaking out in China, they don't have the facilities to even begin dealing with it. And especially with the number of people that they have in India, it could be absolutely catastrophic. Yeah. So those are kind of the three ingredients in the perfect storm. But I want to touch on a couple of other points that have come up in the last few days. First of all, it's a novel virus. That means it's a new virus. Nobody's ever had it before. There's no herd immunity. This is not something that the general populace already has a certain degree of immunity to. Now, the World Health Organization has been very sharply criticized by a lot of people for not being more outspoken and saying this thing is a big deal. For a while, they were saying, hey, you know, they declared an international emergency, but they said there's no reason to restrict travel and trade. It's going to be okay. Now they're changing their tune. Just in the last couple of days, Dr. Tedros, who's the head of the WHO, said it may now be that what we have seen so far is only the tip of the iceberg, and that there is a spark that may light a much bigger fire than we previously anticipated. Now, if you look at WHO's past actions, they seem to be downplaying how serious it is. all of a sudden in the last couple of days, they've stepped up their message to a much more serious tone. Makes me wonder if they know more than we do and that there's more to be concerned about. As I mentioned, Professor Gabriel Leung from Hong Kong University said, at the R-naught numbers that we're seeing for this virus, it has the potential, worst case, to infect 3/4 of the human beings on the entire planet and kill 51 million people. Now, that's not a prediction that that's going to happen. He's saying that's the worst case. The market is not discounting that worst case by any stretch of the imagination. Something I didn't know until Dr. Chris Martinson ferreted this out in one of his recent videos, which I know you watched as well. We are incredibly dependent on China for most of our pharmaceuticals. All of the generic drugs that we buy in the United States, most of them are manufactured in China. Now, as you may know, a lot of them get manufactured in India, but even the ones that are manufactured in India, the Indian pharma companies are buying a lot of their key ingredients from China. So China is in the middle of the supply chain for pharmaceuticals. So if there is a global outbreak, we're going to be incredibly dependent on China to provide the drugs needed to treat it. And obviously, China is not in a position, having right now going through the peak of this outbreak, or hopefully they're close to the peak, if not past it yet. It could be really, really bad. I guess according to Martinson's video, the last penicillin plant that existed in the United States closed in 2004, and we get all of these generic drugs out of China now. So this has the potential of being really big. And the big question at this point is, does it move to not just China and become a global pandemic? And we don't know that yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, that would be my next question. I'm sure that's the question on everybody's mind is just what's the probability of this being a global pandemic? And do we have any guesstimation on that? And if so, what's the level of confidence? I don't know if I haven't heard Dr. Martinson say anything about that. I don't know if you've found anything in your research that would give us some insight on that.
Well, the one place I would disagree with you, what you said, is you said that's the question that's on everybody's mind. I don't think that question is on everybody's mind yet. It very much should be. And I hope that this video will help to get it on people's mind. And again, I'm not predicting that there's any certain outcome that there's going to be a global pandemic. I'm saying it's a very realistic risk that we should think about and take seriously. Very few people are taking the global pandemic risk seriously. So first of all, the 24-day incubation period is maybe scary as hell. But wait a minute. We don't know if there's asymptomatic transmission for the full 24 days. We don't know what percentage of patients would have such a long incubation period, if that's the exception or the rule. So we need to find out more about that. We don't know yet. A little bit more about R-naught and transmissivity. These things change over time, and the virus can mutate, and that changes how much it can be transmitted, the R-naught. It also changes the case fatality rate. One of the things that people are saying about case fatality rates is, SARS had the 11% case fatality rate, and this thing's only 1% or 2%, so it's a completely different animal. Well, that may be true, but SARS had a 3% case fatality rate early on, about the same time as where we are now in its development as an epidemic. And that case fatality rate went up over time as they figured out how to count all the deaths and so on and so forth. So we don't know exactly what the R-naught value is. Most people seem to be assuming it's between 2.5 and 4.0. Anything above 2 is really scary in terms of how contagious it is. But the asymptomatic transmission, where it's very contagious and you've got no way of containing it because the thermometer checks and so forth don't work, that's really scary. Now, there's a little bit of good news here. At one point, the case growth rate inside of China was an incredibly steep exponential progression. It was about 40% per day increase in case count. that case count growth has peaked and rolled over, and it's getting smaller now. We're each subsequent day, we're not seeing 40% more. We're seeing lower numbers of cases added than the day before. Wait a minute, hold on. We've also gotten data out of China that says they're running out of test kits. Well, the reason that the case count is rolling over is because they don't have the ability to, you know, we got as far as 4,000 additional cases per day was kind of the peak. They don't have any more than 4,000 to 6,000 test kits per day. And so there's no way that they can go any higher than that in terms of what they're testing for. There are a lot of reports out of China that people en masse are being turned away from hospitals and unable to get care. It's come out in social media. So it may be that the case count is still growing exponentially and they're just not able to report it yet. But in any case, at one point, it was growing as much as 40% per day in China. Now, a couple of people, particularly Jim Bianco at Bianco Research, are tracking and charting the ex-China growth rate. And so far, it hasn't gone over 10% per day. Now, still, 10% per day is a really pretty aggressive growth rate for anything. But in compared to what the numbers were inside of China, it seems like it's not as high so far. So maybe that was a false indication. Maybe the way that they were misreporting some data, perhaps the Chinese government didn't tell us the truth at first and eventually fessed up and disclosed a whole bunch of cases all at once that made the rate of growth look bigger than it was. I don't know. In any event, so far we're seeing about a 10% daily growth rate in case count outside of China. The people are focusing now mostly, what's got media attention is the lower case fatality rate. And yes, that's really important. I certainly don't want to diminish the importance of that. But we need to think about what it would take to overwhelm the medical facilities of entire countries. And that is a pandemic that spreads and infects a lot of people and has a high serious complication rate, regardless of what the case fatality rate is. So we should be looking at this in terms of the serious complication rate, which appears to be about 15%, not just the case fatality rate, which appears to be about 1%. So I think that the world's not really looking at all of the right numbers quite yet.
Yeah. And I also want to point out on that note that it's not just George and Eric here with our tinfoil hats and our bunker on Skype. You actually had one of your viewers, correct me if I'm wrong, who's a nurse, an ICU nurse, that emailed you saying, yeah, Eric, you're hitting the nail on the head there with that assessment, and that there's only maybe 90,000 beds in the United States, and that's the real problem here.
Yeah, and you know the point that she was making, and you know she does this. She said, "Look, what everybody's saying is, oh, look at that! It's a horrible, horrible humanitarian tragedy in China. Of course, it could never happen here because we've got the American medical system." Right. And what she said to me, she says, look, I'm the American medical system. I work in the ICU. And it is absolutely true that we have incredible, incredible things that we can do here. We can give amazingly, amazingly good care to this tiny, tiny little percentage of the population who needs ICU care at any one moment in time. If you have a Spanish flu-sized epidemic, it completely overwhelms the system. There's only, I think, 94,000 ICU beds in the entire United States. There's no way that we could provide ICU care for people affected by a pandemic. And I think that we do have better medical capabilities than China or India because we don't have as many people competing for a smaller number of hospitals. But still, it could completely overwhelm the system and it has to be taken very seriously.
Yeah. So through your research and just kind of drawing your own conclusions to this, have you found any parts of the story that we could consider good news? I know you touched on a few earlier. Do you have any more to add to that?
There is some good news here, not a whole lot. First of all, per Zhang Nishan, I'm probably mispronouncing his name. Apologies, Dr. Zhang. The epidemic may be peaking in the next couple of months in China. Now, first of all, Dr. Zhang is a senior advisor to the Chinese government. It is conceivable that the Chinese government is pressuring him to say that. We've seen them pressure other people. With one of the big things that's come out of this was there was a doctor in Wuhan who tried to warn people on January 2nd, hey, we've got a really serious problem. This could go epidemic. And he was arrested, detained, and punished for spreading rumors because that's just the way things happen in China. So when Professor Zhang Nishan says it may be peaking or is about to peak, is that really what he honestly thinks? I sure hope so. He has said that before, and it turned out not to be true yet. So I wonder if he's being pressured to say that. But hopefully, it's almost reached its peak in China. Hasn't really started to even get going yet anywhere else. And what everybody's saying is, well, look, there's been very, very little outside of China. So what are you worried about? It seems to be contained in China. Think about that incubation period, maybe being as long as 24 days. It's being spread all around the world. We wouldn't expect it to really take off the way it took off in China quite yet. So it's really, I think we'll know over the next month or so. Curiously, and this is maybe good news for the West, it's not good news for Asia. This is a racist virus, George. It has to do with the way that the virus actually infects cells. The way a virus gets into a cell is through these things called receptors, and there's lots of different kinds of receptors. This particular virus needs a receptor called ACE2. Now, the science of this is way over my head. All I know is, for some reason, people of Asian descent have more of these ACE2 receptors than other people do. That makes them more susceptible. And this is a theory. It hasn't really been confirmed yet. But there is at least a theory that this virus is something that Asian people are much more susceptible to than Caucasians and other races. Now, we don't know that for certain yet. And if we did know it for certain, we don't know how much more susceptible they are. So is the fact that this racist virus only picks on Asian people going to save the West and it's not going to be a problem for the rest of us? Or does it just mean it won't be, you know, it'll only be 90% as bad as it was in China? I have no idea. I don't think anybody does yet, but that's something to watch. There's also a major question on a lot of people's minds, which is the weather. One of the things that's believed about the SARS outbreak in 2003 was that spring weather, warmer temperatures, the virus, when it's on surfaces, can live longer on a surface. And so if somebody touches an elevator button or something and you touch the elevator button again, how long can it last between people touching it before the virus dies? The answer is it gets much shorter as the temperature goes up. And it's believed that one of the things that really helped to contain and end the SARS outbreak was spring weather. Well, it's no surprise that this happened in China during the winter months, during flu season. By the time it really gets going in the rest of the world, we'll be into at least Northern Hemisphere spring and summer. So is spring weather going to save us? It sounds good. It certainly is something to hope for. But wait a minute. Look at where the outbreak is starting to grow outside of China now. It's still very small case counts. But if you look at the rate of change in case counts, how quickly it's growing, Thailand, Indonesia, and Philippines are kind of leading the way, according to Jim Bianco. Well, wait a minute. Those are places that are, you know, 80 degree Fahrenheit temperatures this time of year. So it's growing there. We don't know whether or not weather is going to play a role in saving the day or not. We probably ought to watch carefully the growth rate in places like Australia. You know, it's summer there. And places that have warm weather like Philippines and Thailand, and see what happens. The ex-China fatality trajectory, or I should say the rate of growth of both cases and fatalities, has been lower outside of China so far. At one point, the numbers reported from Hubei were growing at 40% per day. We haven't seen any more than 10% per day outside of China. Now, 10% per day is still an exponential growth trajectory, still a scary number. It grows very, very quickly, but it's not as bad as it appears to have been at one point in China. It is very clear from the officially reported data that it appears that the case count in China has already peaked. But again, there's a lot of reports that are contesting that, saying, wait a minute, the reason it's peaked is basically because medical facilities are overwhelmed. They don't have enough test kits to report any more cases than they already are reporting, and that people are being turned away in droves, not able to get any medical care when they're sick. So we don't really know what the number is. So that's as much good news as I've got.
Right. Okay. Now, I know you emailed me prior to the interview, and you're talking about a report that came out January 29th, I believe, by the Chinese Academy of Sciences, something like that. And you said that might shed some light on where we're going in the future. You want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think this report is very, very important. It is not yet peer reviewed. A lot of scientists tend to discount anything that hasn't been through the peer review process. Remember, the facts are evolving very, very quickly here. We've got to go with the latest information available. It was written by published scientists who have been published in peer reviewed journals before. So it's credible scientists that are writing this stuff. China Academy of Sciences was the lead author. There were several other authors in the study. You can find it online. The really, really scary part is they reported that they believe that the R0 value, that's the transmissivity index, how contagious it is, could be as high as 4.08. That is just super scary in terms, and particularly when you couple that incredibly high contagiousness with asymptomatic transmission, which makes it impossible to contain the outbreak using tests like thermometer checks of fevers and so forth.
Right.
They went on to say that it appeared to them to have a similar case fatality rate to SARS, much higher than people were thinking. Now, very quickly, Dr. Eric Ding, who's an epidemiologist at Harvard University, posted a Twitter thread on this, and he said, look, I've looked at this report very carefully. Their analysis of R0 being at 4, which is super scary, looks really solid. It looks to me like they got it right, and this is a really scary number. But he said, discount that case fatality rate of 6.5% that they reported. The science is over my head. Dr. Ding went off around and talked about the various reasons he disagreed with their approach. He said he didn't really agree with the way they came to that conclusion. And it seems like the data that we've seen since this came out tends to corroborate Dr. Ding's initial reaction, which is believe the R0 value of 4.08, but don't believe the case fatality rate of 6.5%. The critical thing to understand, though, is the combination of super high R0 of over 4 with the inability to contain this through just using a thermometer test because of asymptomatic transmission. What the study concluded is the only way to contain R0 is to control the incubation period and to isolate people so they don't come into contact with other people. This report, when it came out on January 29th, was the light bulb for me. It was like, wait a minute. Nobody could understand why the number of fatalities that was reported in China at that point was less than 500, I think, as of the 29th. The number of cases reported was in the thousands, but not high thousands. It was relatively low. Why the heck are they locking down entire cities in China? Shutting down? I mean, China cares a lot about their industrial production, their exports. Why would they be shutting down factories, shuttering businesses, shutting down the economy, closing down entire cities and putting them on lockdown? This report explains it exactly. And, they had this information, obviously. These people all work for the Chinese government, so the government knew this information before the report was published. This explains that the only way to contain this and to get the R0 from 4 down to 1, which is where you need it to be to contain an outbreak, is to put people in complete isolation. And Dr. Chris Martinson got completely ridiculed for a video he produced because he said, look, people, this explains, number one, he put up a picture of just dead, you know, no traffic on a major street in Shanghai or someplace. He says, this is the explanation for why these lockdowns are happening in China. And he went on to say, what that means is if we have an outbreak where you live, this is what's coming to where you live. And he went on to say, don't wait until, you know, the stores are sold out. Start thinking about, you know, stocking up on groceries and so forth now while there's no panic. And that caused him to be ridiculed. I think Bloomberg published an article ridiculing him, calling him, a conspiracy theorist or something. Wikipedia deleted his Wikipedia page and so forth. So, you know, and this guy's a PhD in pathology from Duke University. What he's saying is, look, read the report and look at its conclusions. Finally, China's actions are explained. Why the heck, over a relatively small number of deaths, would they be locking down entire cities? Because their best scientists have figured out the only way you can contain an R0 of 4 when it has asymptomatic transmission and no way to use thermometer tests is to just isolate people so they don't come into contact with one another for the full incubation period, which at that time in this report was thought to be about 4 or 5 days. Now, since then, this other very reputable guy, Dr. Zhang Hassan, I believe, Nashan, Dr. Zhang Nashan, has said something about a 24-day incubation period. You know, is that just an exception case? Is that, could that be all the time? Do we need to think about the period of lockdown being extended dramatically because of that 24-day finding? We don't know yet. The news is just coming out in the last couple of days. But I think that report from the Chinese Academy of Scientists was the first time that we had an explanation for China's actions. Why are they locking down entire cities in reaction to something which, according to their statistics, had so far only killed a few hundred people? Now, of course, there's conspiracy bloggers all over the internet saying they're hiding the facts, that there's really 50,000 people dead already in China, and they're concealing it. Look, I have no idea of knowing if that kind of thing is true. But it certainly would explain why, based on a low reported fatality number, they were taking such extreme and draconian actions. And, you know, that's a characteristic. Now, do these aspects of this virus, does that apply just to Asian people because of ACE2 receptors? Or is that what we should expect the entire world to go through if the outbreak spreads globally, as I fear that it could? We don't know yet. But again, my point is, I'm not predicting anything. I'm saying markets are not discounting these possibilities, which are all very realistic possibilities.
Yeah. And then taking it back to the macro really quick, I think we should point out that China is doing this in the very worst possible time for them from a macro standpoint. You know, a lot of people that look at this say, oh, well, that's just China. They're authoritarian. They just, that's how they operate. That's their MO. But you don't realize you're right in the middle of a trade war. And there's a lot of things, and correct if I'm wrong, but they're very short of dollars as well. So there's a lot of macro things that would point to the fact that this is just the worst timing. And if anything at all, they would be less draconian than normal because of the ramifications to their exports or everything else that's going on. And I know you know a lot more about that than I do. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, as you said, George, the Asian and Chinese culture particularly is a little bit different than what Americans are used to. We really, really cherish individual rights. And a lot of what the U.S. Constitution is about is saying that the rights of just one individual outweigh everything else. You can't, these are inalienable rights that you cannot take away from somebody no matter what. The Asian mindset is different from that. And it's not just governments. A lot of people in society don't agree with that philosophy. They think, wait a minute, what systems and societies should be set up to do is to take care of the greater good, take care of the whole. And if that means that the rights of a few individuals have to be sacrificed in order to do, to make the best choice for society as a whole, so be it. So I think that China is, it's true, more open to draconian measures that impose on the individual rights and liberties of human beings than other governments are. That's true. But they also, quite frankly, value their economy. I would go so far as to say almost more than they value humanity. You know, they do not want to shut down this growth machine of Chinese commerce. And the fact that they are doing that now, it started over the Lunar New Year holiday where a lot of production was shut down anyway. This the Chinese New Year is a bigger deal than any other holiday. It's like Christmas in the United States, but it's an even bigger deal than Christmas in the United States. A lot of things were shut down so that workers could go home to their families. They've already shut down Lunar New Year. Sorry if you plan to celebrate with your family. You know, you're quarantined. You don't have to like it. Tough luck. That was not directly impacting the economy nearly as much as continuing those lockdowns after Chinese New Year is over, which is this week. So they have started to send some people back to work. That's true, but not very many. And the fact that they're continuing these lockdowns, and they just added Chengdu, which is the capital city of Sichuan province, and Guangzhou, which is the capital city of Guangdong province. They just added those two major cities of Guangzhou is at least 14 million people. I don't know how big Chengdu is, but you know these are bigger than New York City sized places. They just added two more to the list this past weekend. So the and you know Shenzhen, which is the biggest center of manufacturing for export, is one of the cities that they have shut down. So they're taking this incredibly seriously, and they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't take that economic burden unless they absolutely had to. And again, this paper from the 29th explains the reason. The only way to contain it, to get the R-naught down to where you stop the outbreak, is to isolate people completely so that they don't transmit it.
Yeah. I mean, just, I think from an American standpoint, you hear all those weird names and cities and it just doesn't really sink in until you say, okay, what would the United States look like if we shut down Chicago, New York, Miami, Dallas, San Francisco, and LA? And that's less than what China has already done.
But well, in terms of number of people in China, some counts have suggested that the number of people affected by lockdowns in China already exceeds the entire population of the United States.
Right.
Is that a real statistic or was that exaggerated by a blogger someplace? I can't tell, but it's a really huge number. Cities that have twice as many people as New York City, like 10 cities that size, have been shut down. This is a really, really big deal.
Yeah. So I know in the media, there's a lot of talks about a specific cure for the coronavirus. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, we're talking about Gilead Pharmaceuticals, which is a major pharmaceutical company, has a drug, probably mispronouncing this, but I believe it's called Remdesivir. And it was originally developed to treat Ebola. It didn't work very well, never made it out of clinical trials, never has been licensed or approved for use in any country anywhere in the world. It is believed to be effective against this virus, and that is terrific news. It's great news. But again, what happened is as soon as that news came out that there is a drug that may be useful in treating this epidemic, all of a sudden the stock market is racing to new all-time highs again. Wait a minute. Look, what this means is if you were to have a global pandemic that could potentially shut down the entire global economy, you wouldn't have as many people dying because although the medical facilities would be completely overwhelmed and there wouldn't be nearly enough of this remdesivir to go around, they'd be able to produce some of it and that would help to treat some of the people. And we don't know yet how effective it is, but hopefully it would, let's say it was incredibly effective. By the time you went through clinical trials and got it approved to use and manufactured a whole bunch of it, even if it was done on an emergency basis, you're talking months and months and months before it would have a meaningful impact on a global pandemic in terms of providing any useful remedies or cures. Again, I'm not saying we're going to have a global pandemic, but I am saying that a global pandemic is a very real possibility, and people need to start taking it seriously. They're not.
Yeah. So let's go back to the fatality rate quickly. I know that you've put a lot of thought into this and really have some numbers. So I don't want to be too alarmist. I don't want to, you know, have people say, oh, you're just blowing this out of proportion or, you know, whatever they say. So let's just stick with the numbers that you've come up with. Mm-hmm. Do you want to go over that?
Well, the first thing to understand is when you hear the press saying that, well, this virus is known to only have a case fatality rate of about 2%. Where they got that number from is they take the death toll and divide it by the reported case count, and that's the case fatality rate. That number is only valid and meaningful after the fact. In other words, when you have an accurate case count of all the cases that really existed and a final death toll after the whole thing is over with, then you can determine the true case fatality rate. The SARS virus, when it was about as far along in its development as an epidemic as we are right now with the nCoV virus, it had about a 3.8% case fatality rate. Now, that's higher than the 2% that we're seeing now, but the point is it went from 3.8% up to 11% by the time it was over. So it's the fact that the current death toll divided by the current case count doesn't really mean anything. The other thing is the period of time, the time lag, because the case count is growing exponentially, you can't say, well, I'm going to take the death toll and divide it by the cases. The cases that are reported as of today are mostly new cases because these cases are growing so quickly. Right. If what you said is, well, let's take a look at from the time that you get diagnosed to the time that you die, if you're going to die, how many days is that? Divide the current death toll by whatever the case count was X number of days ago. If you do it that way, you can get numbers as high as 11% for this current virus. Well, that's scary as hell. But wait a minute, there's some good news. A lot of people think that the case count itself has been completely underreported because they're only willing to use a test kit on somebody in China who looks like they're a serious case. Right. So anybody who's just showing moderate symptoms isn't even being tested. If you take all of those cases that occur and say, well, let's estimate that there's a much, much higher case count than what's actually been reported, because this thing is so incredibly contagious with the high R-naught value, maybe there's 10 times as many infected people as been reported. And if there's the same death toll, well, that would mean that instead of being a 10% fatality rate, it's a 1% fatality rate. So there's, and of course, the other side of that is if the death toll, there's some reports out of China saying that people are just being sent for cremation with, and if they were never tested before they died, they don't get counted as dying of this virus. It's just unknown cause of death and it doesn't get counted. And there have been supposedly many, many people sent to crematoriums in the last several days or in the last several weeks. If their death toll is much higher than reported, then that would tend to move the number in the other direction. The real point is we don't know the case fatality rate. What we do know from several different independent sources is it looks like there's reason to believe that two things will be true about this virus compared to SARS. One is it's likely that the case fatality rate is probably lower than SARS was. How much lower? We don't know. But it looks like this will be much more contagious because of asymptomatic transmission, making it hard to contain it. A lot more people are going to get it. So already it's killed many more people, 1,018 people as of this morning compared to 800 total in the SARS epidemic. We don't know if that 1,000 number is really higher. Some people say it is. And we don't know what's going to happen outside China yet. And the fact that nothing of significance has happened outside China yet is not reason to conclude that it won't. It's too soon to know that yet. And particularly with this new data saying that the incubation period could be as long as 24 days, it could be a month before we see whether or not this turns into a global pandemic. So we don't know what's going to happen. If it starts to go pandemic around the world, it's going to be a really, really big deal.
Right. And you also emailed me that German story about the virus living on actual surfaces for, I think it was up to 12 days. So, I mean, how does that play into this?
Well, yeah, the report, and again, it is credible scientists. You know, this report was not peer reviewed because of the timing, but it's written by people who are have been previously published in peer reviewed journals. They're credible guys. I don't know exactly what that report said. I haven't seen the report myself. One said 5 days, one said 12 days. I'm not sure who's right. Maybe they were talking about different temperatures. I know that with the SARS virus, there was a huge difference in terms of how long the virus could last on surfaces. So somebody touches an elevator button, handle to a door, grab handle on public transportation, you know, one of the things you hang on to on the bus. How long can the virus live on that? It's not minutes or seconds, it's days. And that, I think, is the important conclusion from the German study. What's that number of days? Is it 5 days? Is it 12 days? I've heard both of those statistics. I'm guessing that that's a range based on temperature, but that's speculation on my part. I don't know exactly what it says. I haven't read that study myself. It sounds, though, like we need to be very concerned about disinfecting surfaces. And, you know, the most important thing you can do to protect yourself from this is just wash your hands several times a day, and particularly after you touch anything, you know, that's foreign to you. Go on a bus, out in a public place or whatever. First thing you do when you get home is wash your hands. That will do more to prevent the spread of this virus than anything else.
Yeah. And I know that I was watching another one of Dr. Martinson's videos, and he talked about the virus now potentially being airborne, like an aerosol, and spreading that way. So have you done any research on that?
Well, it was actually that video that clarified it for me, something I had not understood. Everybody's been talking about how this virus spreads, and it's in droplets. Somebody sneezes within about 6 feet of where you're standing. The little droplets of moisture that come out of their mouth may contain the virus. If you breathe that in, you've got it. So wearing masks and trying to, they call it social distancing, trying to avoid being within 6 feet of other people, strangers, wherever possible, particularly if they appear to be sick at all. Those are the things that you do to protect yourself from this. But what I didn't understand is droplet infection and aerosol infection are two completely different things. If you remember the Dustin Hoffman movie with Morgan Freeman with the virus, and there's this one, you know, pivotal scene in the movie where he's like, oh my God, it's mutated, it's airborne. Well, what they're now saying in the last couple of days about this virus is that it can be spread through aerosol, not just droplets. And I didn't understand, what's the difference between droplet and aerosol? It means if you cough, it's not just people within 6 feet of you. It's now that virus is in the air, and the air conditioning system could take it to a completely different part of the building that you're in. And somebody who's breathing the air that comes out of the AC vent over their head could get something that came from a person that was, you know, hundreds of feet away from them in a different room.
Yeah.
So it's a different mechanism, and they call it airborne or aerosol transmission. It's only in the last, I'd say 72 hours that the news has come out confirming that this can be transmitted. So it's incredibly transmissive. It's very, very contagious. It can spread. And the thing is, what a lot of people are saying is, look, you guys, Eric, George, you must be totally nuts. Open your eyes. There's barely any deaths outside of China. It's not, you know, hospitals are not being overwhelmed around the world. What are you talking about? You guys are crazy. This is only in China. Okay. It's super contagious, and it's super contagious when the person who's transmitting it and the person who's getting it don't feel any symptoms. How do you know that you don't already have it and the people around you don't already have it unless you've been tested? You don't know that. And people have been flying for months now in and out of China to all other parts of the world. And this came just before Lunar New Year, which is when Chinese people go and see their family. So if your family lives in, you know, Acapulco and you're Chinese from Wuhan, the time you would go travel outside of China to visit with family is going to be Lunar New Year when everybody has time off. It's like time off for Christmas. Mm-hmm. So it is in 5 million people left the city of Wuhan before Lunar New Year, most of them to go visit with family, some of them because they heard there was going to be a some kind of lockdown and they've got afraid and fled. But there's been people traveling all over the place. There's no reason that we should expect the rest of the world to start experiencing pandemic conditions yet. And what really got my attention is the World Health Organization, after repeatedly being criticized by experts who thought that they were just downplaying this too much, all of a sudden, in the last 72 hours, Dr. Tedros, who previously just couldn't stop talking about how, hey, there's no reason for concern, we don't want to stoke fear and panic, now he's changed his tune and he's saying, it could be that this is just the tip of the iceberg. Those are his words, not mine. This could be the spark that starts a fire that's much bigger than we previously thought. That's paraphrased from memory, but that's approximately what Dr. Tedros, head of the WHO, said in the last 48 hours. So all of a sudden, the WHO is changing their tune. And I think that, to me, is a sign that we may be about to get more bad news.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.